Welcome, my fellow Mepsters, to the fourth episode of the Third Med Podcast. I want to start out this episode as a reminder that the Marine Corps ball is right around the corner. Some of you need to stop going to Lawson's and Family Mart and instead go to the gym and the dry cleaner. I know it might be a struggle now to start a diet, but it's going to be less of a struggle on your buttons when you're trying to cha-cha slide in the Marine Corps ball. Again, today's episode will cover history. Again, with the man, the myth, the legend himself, Major Wilson. Welcome back. In our last episode, we covered as much as you can cover between 600 BC to 300 BC in about an hour. So what are we going to be talking about this time, sir?
I'm going to start with the Romans and just cover the Punic Wars, but then we'll fast forward in time to the Seven Years' War, the birth of the U.S., and finish it off with kind of the Napoleonic era. So we'll go from about 264 BC to 200-ish BC, and then fast forward to 1756.
All right. So just to revisit, you know, for the people that are just turning in and listen to the last episode, there's people out there who do that, you know. I don't like those kind of people, you know. I personally would listen to every episode. But you are Major Lonnie Wilson. You have been with the 3rd Meb for about 2 months, you said, sir?
Yeah, a little over 2 months.
Yes, sir. And you work in
G3 Future Operations Section.
And you are a huge history buff, a humble one of that one, as you said before. You said you're more of a student than a teacher, yet, again, I would say you're a history book with legs. Mm. So you said we're going to be talking about Romans.
Yes, principally the Punic Wars. So you asked me a question last time, why do we still, why do we use Latin phrases? I guess a simple answer would be because they won the Punic Wars. So these were considered three wars. The first one started in 264 BC, and then the last one was around 200 BC. I'm just going to talk about the first two and just some aspects of them. So the first Punic War, and the Punic Wars are Rome and Carthage. Carthage is an extinct town in Tunisia, and the inhabitants at the time were considered Phoenicians, is what they're considered in history. So economic competition between Rome and Carthage. Rome is a ascending power, and they meet in battle for the first time in 264 BC. Really, the first Punic War, what's worthwhile from it, and what I've learned while I was in Quantico from the professor that I really looked up to, is he talked about this battle as a battle of domains. And when one power is able to have complete control of a domain, whether that's the water or the surface, or excuse me, water or land or air or space or cyber now, but when you're able to control a domain or take control where you didn't have it before, that is what he looks at as turning points in history for nations becoming the power. And that's kind of what happened in the first Punic War. So Rome, primarily a land force, it's expanding out, and the battle is centered around Sicily, so the island on the south of the Italian peninsula. Carthage had investments there, and Rome wants them. Rome is not a naval power, but they invest heavily in their navy. The Carthaginians are a naval power in the Mediterranean, but they're projecting power from the northern Africa coast, from Tunisia to Sicily. So Rome is the dominant land force in this battle, but what they're unable to do is they're unable to get the Carthaginians into a land battle that is decisive, into a land battle that that if they were able to win it, then they will be dominant. So they're thinking through ways, what to do and how to come about this. And again, this is a simple tactical thing, but at the same time, if we compare it to some of the things that are coming into our lexicon now, the Nemesis, the naval strike missiles, these different weapon systems that allow dominance of a domain, I think it starts to make more sense. The Romans, they invest in their navy, they build these ships, but what they do then is they add this thing called a corvus on their ship. And all a corvus is it's this big gangplank that when the ship's underway, it's kind of straight up in the air. And then they ram the ship into the adversary ship. They drop this gangplank with a spike on the end of it down into the other ship, and it allows them to have a land battle at sea. And so the Romans put these on all their ships, and then they go hunting for the Carthaginian navy, and they ram their ships into them. They drop the corvus. They send their boarding parties across, or their equivalent of marines, so not rowers, not oarsmen, but legionnaires equipped with, you know, the short swords across the gangplanks, and they destroy the Carthaginian navy that way. That allows Rome dominance of both the land and the naval domains in and around Sicily. Carthage sues for terms of peace, and Rome is becoming the dominant power.
Mm-hmm.
But Carthage didn't go away quietly. And so fast forward, Carthage had been, instead of investing in Sicily, now they're using their navy and they're crossing over to what is current day Spain. Mm-hmm. And if you're familiar with Cartagena, Spain, that is new Carthage. And so this this family called the Barcas are expanding the Carthaginian Empire onto Spain, onto the continent, with onto the continental Europe. And the Barcas, there's Hannibals and Hannstrubals, and multiple different name people that with the same name, so it gets really confusing to listen to. But the one that's really survived history and has kind of captivated military historians and military leaders for a long time, this guy named Hannibal Barca.
Mm.
And he is in Cartagena, Spain, or New Carthage, and he is going to fight Rome. This is the Second Punic War, and he's going to end the Roman Empire. And mm-hmm. he does something no one's ever done before. He gathers an army, and he is able to overland, cross mountains, cross what had seemingly been impenetrable geographic obstacles, and descend upon the Italian peninsula.
Mm-hmm.
And en route there, there's this, you know, there's multiple different battles. There's a battle of Lake Trebia. Rome is just getting, they're just getting slaughtered. And Hannibal is the next Alexander the Great, the next great captain. He is just this juggernaut leading this military and threatening Rome itself. Mm-hmm. Rome's not, Italy's not a united country at this point. There's little empires all over the place. It's kind of the city-state idea is still there. It's not a league. And so as Hannibal gets into or onto the Italian peninsula, some places they are they're siding with them so that they don't have to go to war with them. Other places are offering resistance. Rome has its military, and it's out there, and it's going to end Hannibal. He's there. Rome has numerical superiority, so they're confident that they're, even though Hannibal is able to cross into Italy, that they will be able to destroy his army. Rome's got a really interesting method of command and control at the time. Every other day, a new leader is in charge. So there's two elected consuls, and one, you know, Monday it's Consul A, and Tuesday it's Consul B, and everybody remembers Varro because he's the one that lost it all for him. And the way that happened, so Hannibal lures the Roman army into this place called Cannae. And Cannae, it's a river on one side, a small hill on the other, so a little valley, and he set up camp there, and he has picked the ground that he's going to fight in. And still the phalanx, you know, some distances have changed, things have evolved, but in general it's the same thing. It's massed troops, formations geometrically arranged, and everybody decides that they're going to meet in battle at a certain place, and when they decide to meet in battle, then these two geometric formations smash into each other, and whoever owns the land at the end of the battle is the victor.
How do you remember these names, by the way?
read books about them and
you just kind of stick eventually.
Yeah, I mean, you're only asking me about things I pretend to know. If you started asking me about things I didn't know.
I mean, I know about a few things, but I can't remember the details, like the city names. Like, I'll probably try to explain this later because I heard this maybe 10 minutes ago, and you described something I find fascinating is, like, setting the planks down with the spikes in the bottom.
Corvus?
Yeah, and I don't remember the name. Yeah. It's been 5 minutes, I don't remember.
It's trade-offs. I mean, my boss is mad at me because he says I haven't seen the classic movies that are required of having a good office.
Oh, absolutely. So. Yeah, you have to, like, if you haven't seen Star Wars, or, Lord of the Rings, or trying to think of the Marvel movies right now, but then again, I digress. I apologize.
Well, what I'll say is when you got four kids and another one on the way,
mm-hmm.
I'm very limited in the my ability to do things aside from like monitor what the children are doing and maybe mm-hmm. read some books. But
mm-hmm.
I once fancied myself a woodworker, but that's too much time away from the kids. So you stay in the house, read books. Talk to the kids about it. And it's funny, too, because we homeschool. This is actually the stuff my wife's teaching to the kids
mm-hmm.
right now is this kind of period of history. So there's, we get it at home as well.
All right. Fair enough, sir.
But
I'm sorry I interrupted.
Not at all.
I am fascinated by your talent to do this.
Yeah. Well, like I said, we'll find something that I don't know and I'll show you the limits of my intellect.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to quiz you on Marvel Comics next. Yeah.
So.
Go on, sir. I apologize.
No, not at all. So Hannibal lures the Romans in. They're pretty confident that that they're going to end him. I think they outnumber him. It's fairly even, but I think Hannibal is outnumbered. I may be wrong on that. Phalanx. That's the formation, but Hannibal has a plan again in this one. And instead of the two phalanxes meeting, he knows that. That's probably not going to work for him. He's well away from his, he's behind enemy lines, for
mm-hmm.
lack of a better term. And so what he's going to do in this circumstance is he actually weakens his center and he strengthens the outside wings. And if you think of like a drum almost, or like a really loose drum, and if you push on the center and it's going to depress in, and if it's, or, something more elastic than even a drum, but you push on the center and eventually the outside is going to collapse.
Kind of concave around into itself.
Yep, it's going to cave in. And that's Hannibal's plan. It's a dangerous plan because if the center is too strong and the wings are too weak, he'll lose. If the center is too weak and the Romans are able to penetrate all the way through, then he's going to have two different isolated wings that the Romans would be able to surround and destroy.
Mm-hmm.
So he figured out what was just going to be right enough. And in that kind of warfare, being able to cave in the center, that is a sign of progress. That's something that, if you're the commander watching it and you see that your forces are caving in the center of the phalanx, and everything is indicating to you that progress is being made in a satisfactory manner. And that's kind of how the battle starts to unfold, except Hannibal's plan was to allow that all to happen so that his wings eventually caved around the Roman army. They're surrounded, and then they just slaughtered them all. I mean, this is warfare with short swords, and an immensely personal affair, and people are being hacked to death all day long. Surviving out of this, is just hardly any of the Romans.
Mm.
And what's interesting about this, or what's fascinating, and again, why do we have, another reason why we have Roman quotations instead of Phoenician quotations, is because although that happened, and Varro, the general or the consul of the day, allowed that to happen for the Romans, Rome did not give up. They changed their strategy. They elected different consuls. They changed the system to where it was just one person in charge to avoid that kind of command and control snafu. And so they put this guy named Fabian in charge, and all Fabian did was delay. Instead of trying to fight a decisive battle and destroy Hannibal, he was just trying to delay him from being able to directly attack Rome.
Mm.
surviving out of that, out of this Battle of Cannae, was this guy that would eventually become Scipio Africanus. And Scipio, as time went on, I don't remember what it was between the what the totality of this time was, but I mean, it's we're talking like near decade time frame. Scipio becomes a general. Scipio takes a, and he builds an army, and he isolates the army. Instead of being out there fighting, fighting Hannibal over the course of these, you know, 10 or 17 years or whatever it was, Scipio, he grows up, he builds this army, and it becomes the most well-drilled and capable army in Rome. And he's facing pressure throughout this time to employ the army, but he is resistant to the pressure, and he is waiting. He's buying his time because he knows that over time, as long as Rome holds out, Hannibal is his lifeline back to New Carthage is dwindling, and he is becoming weaker and weaker, and Scipio is becoming stronger and stronger.
I just find it fascinating. So this man's a, you know, brilliant tactician, great general, and his name is Scipio.
Scipio.
What a name.
Scipio. yes, and he is, I'd say he's fairly well known, but not probably not even as well known as Hannibal, because Hannibal reemerges as a, you know, this Battle of Cannae is considered, and some consider it as a battle in and of itself, as a single event, quite possibly the greatest battle ever fought. The greatest, the most well thought out and executed single battle.
Why would that battle stand out compared to like other battles, like, you know, against Spartans versus the Persians, or?
Because of the totality of the loss of an entire army, adversary army. I mean, the sheer magnitude of the loss of the army in such a short period of time. You're talking the combat power of a city-state nearly destroyed in an afternoon. I mean, I think it was like, don't quote me on this, but for some reason, 60,000 people slaughtered by short swords in an afternoon.
Okay, that's a fair, that's so a, the that's magnet, a fair reason.
So, yes, so like... The magnitude of that, you know, it, I don't even know how, like, I don't know how you would compare it to something today, but it, the Battle of Cannae was an obsession, like, it, and it was the foundation of the German plan in World War One, and it was the foundation of what was called the von Schlieffen plan. So when that war started, how they envisioned their forces maneuvering across Europe into France, and it's well documented. So I mean, it's captivated people, it's discussed, it was studied in schools, but it was just a single battle in a campaign that was ultimately lost, and that's the fascinating thing. And I think that's the thing, you know, in my education as a Marine, when we're company grade officers, we're there to win battles, and but the battles that we're fight, we're ideally put in position as part of a broader campaign that is connecting those tactical actions with the objectives of the entirety of the employment of the military force. And so in the campaign, you're planning series of battles, and we'll talk about that at length when we get to World War II, but series of battles that connect the tactical actions to the ultimate objective. In this situation, although Hannibal was able to destroy the Roman, nearly destroy the Roman army in a battle, his campaign of subjugating the Italian peninsula was ultimately failed, and he never was able to enter Rome. He was never able to compel his terms on the Roman people. They held out. They held out. They refused Hannibal. That's where this general Fabian comes in, because the Romans were also a proud people. And they wanted to go out, okay, we lost this battle, but let's go fight another decisive battle real quick and take it. And Fabian, he was much more of a skirmish, not a set-piece battle where a decision was going to be made. So you hear from time to time this thing called a Fabian strategy, and a Fabian strategy is just a delaying strategy, delaying to allow you to set conditions for what would be eventually decisive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where Scipio comes in because he, like I said, he built this army. It was the most thoroughly drilled, and he'd implemented new systems of command. We'd call them systems of command and control, but how he, and we look back on them, they're simple things. Like, it's literally close order drill. It's the remnants of close order drill. Like, how you shift from a column, from a line to a column. How you turn right, turn left, or march obliquely, however it may be, but to maneuver your forces. You know, we still do it. It's close order drill, and we use it for the teamwork and the cohesiveness and kind of that being able to think and do things as a group, as a baseline training kind of endeavor. And so Scipio's building this military, and then eventually they meet at this place called Zama, and Scipio ends. It's another grand battle, but at that point, his military had become so weak, and they'd been so far from home for so long that Scipio was able to deliver victory back to Rome. That's the second Punic War. And then the third Punic War is like a war of retribution, and it's interesting reading about, almost much more so for the dialogue in the Roman Senate than it is for the actual actions that occurred, because it's a discussion about conclusion of conflict. And at this point, the Roman Senate, and specifically I think his name was Cato, was a senator. He gave these dramatic discussions about how if they don't wipe Carthage off the face of the earth, they'll be fighting Carthage forever, or Carthage will eventually be able to rebuild their strength, and by continual conflict with Carthage, Rome will never be able to realize its full potential, because it'll always be happening to make investments in fighting Carthage. And he eventually convinces the Senate to fund an expedition. The Romans cross the Mediterranean, and when you hear the term salt the earth, they literally did that with Carthage. I mean, you can still see the remnants of Carthage on the imagery when you look at Tunisia, but at the time they just obliterated the city. They burned it down. They subjugated the people. They destroyed every building, and Carthage as a Phoenician city ceased to exist after that. And that's, like I said, that was about 200 BC. So then from that point forward, I mean, you have great stories of Roman emperors and Pompey and Caesar, Julius Caesar and Caesar Augustus, and you have Rome's influence throughout. I mean, Julius Caesar is going all the way to Great Britain. He's crossing over, and he's finding the edge of the empire in Great Britain. They're campaigning all through North Africa. They're campaigning all through Jerusalem, and you see the Roman influence on the Jewish religions, the birth of the Christian religions, and eventually, the extent of the empires of Rome is met with the extent of the empires of the Muslim religions later on. But it's just fascinating, like, whether or not you're, you know, anybody's religious, to read the history of the 10th Legion in Jerusalem and the discussions, you know, from the Bible, the give unto Caesar what is Caesar's and give unto the Lord what is the Lord's, and what that actually means, not from a, you know, not from a religious aspect as much as it meant from, well, what is a client kingdom? What is this client kingdom of Judea that is supposedly led by this king named Herod, but has oversight by this guy named Pontius Pilate, that allows internal collection of taxes to be paid back to Rome for the protection of the client kingdom against whatever is, whatever forces are out to the east that are constantly trying to penetrate into the empire. I mean, it's just, they're fascinating stories. But from that point forward, the next, aside from the battles, the battles of Caesar and Pompey. There's a one other battle in the history of Rome. It's in Adrianople. I think that's like in Turkey. And this is a, I didn't write the date down on this, but this is a like a 400-ish AD at this point battle. And the worthwhile discussion about this battle in Adrianople is that that was the Romans lost, and that was the last battle of expansion in the Roman Empire. And so at the the time of Julius Caesar and Caesar Augustus, and for the years after, going back to Gladiator, so Marcus Aurelius, a Roman Empire, and that they're fighting through Germany at that point, what became Germany at that point. I mean, the legions would march 20 miles a day, and they would get to a stopping point, and they would have all their logistics there. They would dig in, and they would be prepared for battle, and they were, you know, this disciplined, incredible war machine. But at Adrianople, you started to see the decadence of the couple hundred years of Roman Empire come taking its toll on them, and they did not march like that. They did not emphasize logistics. They did not emphasize combat readiness. And so the empire's expansion, you know, this expansion stopped at this period of time in 400-ish AD. And then you have, you know, I'm going to fast forward through a couple hundred years worth of history here, but you have, you still have fascinating dialogues about, I mean, you have August of Hippo, or St. Augustine, as he's known in some of the Christian religions, and he writes this defense of Christianity, and it's a discussion, and it's a logical examination of what caused the fall of the Roman Empire. And like, this is a, you know, this is a volume almost like Homer, except for Christianity, that is really a, it's, this book is called The City of God, and it's not so much whether or not you think Christians caused the fall of Rome, as you see the method and logic in the book that is fascinating. And it's a new way of examining the causal factors and the phenomena that people have experienced in life, and assigning a reason for it, and then being able to develop new forms of government or develop new ideas so that you don't have to repeat that. And that book is a foundational book to later on this guy named Thomas Aquinas, and who also becomes venerated in a few of the Christian religions, and he writes this book called Summa Theologica. So he uses a Latin term again, but his book is an examination, again, using August of Hippo's work, using what's known of the Bible, using some of these philosophers that have been discussed, that have, they've really taken their work, and always in the examination of conflict and the examination of the human condition and these situations of conflict, and how humans band together to civilize or to develop communities, and how those communities choose their values and evaluate their values. And so Thomas Aquinas' book refines the method from August of Hippo's book. What's significant about that is that this book now starts to percolate through, you know, if you're looking at Europe in this period of time, there's plagues and there's feudal empires and there's, you know, there's all this stuff going on without any kind of unifying reason or really seeming at times progress. It's called the Middle Ages or the Dark Ages or whatever it may be. But Aquinas's book sparks this intellectual
debate
and discussion into a, you know, then we start getting into the Renaissance, and then you get into this period of enlightenment. And it, the period of enlightenment, I always get a kick at out of, because it's also a period of incredible warfare across the world, the first global conflict. So, you know, I'm trying to draw a little bit of a line up to the 7 years, you know, 7 years war, which is really the first world war, the 7 years war. Mm-hmm. So it's the principal belligerents in this is France and Spain, but then you have all the empires in Europe. You have Russia, and you have, you know, different empires of Austria, and Germany is not a country. It's a handful of Prussians and and a couple other empires' names escape me. But you have, like I said, the principal belligerents of France and Britain. In the States, it's also termed the French and Indian War. So this period of time is also super fascinating to me, because here's where you see, when we talk about domains and when you find what does the Navy do for an empire type question, you really see that answered here. Because in Great Britain, they have, this is a, you know, the really one of the first times they're able to project an army across an ocean, across the Atlantic Ocean, into North America, and wage war with remnants of French and with elements of the French here on the continent, at the same time as fighting naval campaigns all along the European coast, into Africa, all the way to India. There's naval campaigns occurring, and you have strategic investments being made by Britain. So they have choices. They're siding with the Prussians. The Prussians are fighting the French on the European continent. Does Britain send its army to the European continent to accelerate the war with France on the side of Prussia, or do they send their army to the North American continent and seize the terrain and really force the French into Canada, but take this new and very lucrative territory from them? And how do they do all these things? It's really fascinating to read about, because they principally invested in their Navy. They sent their army to the continental U.S., and then they subsidized the self-titled Frederick the Great in Prussia to fight just enough of a war, not a decisive victory, not something that Frederick the Great could develop his own empire and be a threat to Britain from, but just enough. We're going to pay just enough for you to cause so much problems for France and its allies that now they can't make an investment anywhere, and we are going to own them all around the globe. And it's a really fascinating story, because all that money that Great Britain used to subsidize such things, to build its navy and to protect its colonies and expand its territory in the United States, someone had to pay for it. So they thought, well, we just sent this whole military over there to help those colonists out on North America. They should pay some taxes for this. And we all know where that story starts, with the American Revolution. So the remnants of victory in the Seven Years' War become a causal factor for the spark that ignited the American Revolution, as early as 10 years later, but really kind of 20 years later in 1776 with the Declaration of Independence. When you take some of just the fantastic stories about the founding fathers out of it, but you just look at the naval, the naval campaigns, because we're so inherently tied with the Navy, and no one can really control the seas, but who is the dominant power at any given point on the seas goes back to that Corvus story that we talked about with the Romans, and about the destiny of a nation as it relates to its ability to dominate a domain. And so France had neglected its navy. It neglected its entire infrastructure for its navy in the lead up to the Seven Years' War. And because they'd neglected their navy and Great Britain had made such investments in its navy, it was able to project power and project a higher relative combat power across the world. And that, that gave them an advantage advantage in the Seven Years' War. But it came at the cost, and France recognized the shortfall on this. And so France, in the years after the 7 Years' War, of course, they still hated the Brits, but they recognized the need for their navy. And so you see French investments back into its naval infrastructure, while you see in the United States, in the colonies, all the stories that we grew up with George Washington and the campaigns across the East Coast, but really the you know, the one that is just fantastic is the Battle of Yorktown, mm-hmm. when you have, you know, you have George Washington seizing an entire British army. So at the time, in the lead up to Yorktown, you had Cornwallis for Great Britain down south, and then there was a concentration of British forces up in New York, and Washington was outside of New York, and he thought that the battle was going to be there in New York, but then he got word that Cornwallis had moved back up into Virginia and had moved down towards Norfolk. At the same time, just, you know, almost, you know, pure fate or whatever it may be, is when the French fleet, who'd been even farther north than New York, I think they're up in outside of Maine or somewhere like that, they'd just been missed by the British fleet, and the British fleet's in the New York Harbor, and they're canalized in there. And Washington gets word that Cornwallis is, you know, he's headed towards Norfolk, and he's able to coordinate with the French fleet. The French fleet sails for the Chesapeake. Excuse me, no, the French fleet sailed down south, and they narrowly avoided a hurricane, but then they were able to get back up to Chesapeake, and by the French fleet being at that narrow entrance to the Chesapeake Bay, it isolated the Brits, and the maritime terrain there was too disadvantageous for the British to try and attempt a naval campaign of any consequence there. So by land and by sea, the French and the colonists were able to seize Cornwallis's army and get his army to surrender, and that was kind of the nail in the coffin for Great Britain insofar as its investments militarily in the United States, and they looked more towards the Caribbean at that point. But, you know, those were the factors that we needed as a, you know, as a nation to at least create the distance for the Declaration of Independence to be realized and the Constitution and the government to be developed. I think it's, you know, it's fascinating because all those ideas are kind of, at least I've found the line how they play out from our ideas present in antiquity in Greece and Rome all the way through the Enlightenment. It doesn't mean that the same ideas were used or the same consequences or same factors were used. It means that these ideas from antiquity were the ones that were debated and tried to maintain, you know, relevance of and an examination of, you know, of their utility. And so that gets us up to the end of the revolution. While that's happening in the United States, or in what becomes the United States, and we had such assistance from the French, from Rochambeau and Lafayette, and all these great characters from history, the same ideas are being sparked in France. They'd lost a 7 years' war. They'd been a nation dominated by the influence of the Catholic Church, mm-hmm. and the ideas you have prior to this, obviously the Protestant Reformation and various other things, but now you have sparks of new ideas or for change in France, and this idea of liberty and equality and fraternity, you know, kind of becomes their rallying cry. But what happens is the government is more or less dissolving, and there's power vacuums, and in those power vacuums are where, you know, the great captains step into. So you have this guy named Napoleon Bonaparte.
Mm-hmm. I've heard of that guy.
Yeah. And yeah. Yeah, he steps into the breach. He's like a young artillery officer. You know, there's nothing on the outset, there's nothing special about him. No real defining characteristic, but then
besides his height.
What's that?
Besides his height.
Yeah, yeah, substandard height and mm-hmm. kind of a pot belly. Mm-hmm. You know, he's good but not great. But he's also opportunistic, and once he sees the opportunity, then you see that his capabilities just far exceed the average person. So he's a general. He's, you know, quickly a general. He's campaigning all the way, you know, all through through Egypt and into Gaza and into what had become, you know, what Palestine and what becomes Israel. The French government is taking on different forms, but he's growing more and more powerful through his exploits on the battlefield, his and his organizational capabilities. And his drive, and eventually, I mean, I'm going to be the emperor, and he's the emperor of France. And then you see something new, up to that point. So the militaries the militaries were small, in relative comparison to the populations of the countries that produced them. And it was like a, you know, prior to Napoleon, it was like a willingness to accept defeat. As long as the resolution from the conflict didn't really have a huge impact on the majority of people's day-to-day lives. That's a poor way of saying it, but what you saw in like the 7 Years' War on Europe was smaller militaries that would fight out a battle, and then that would force a discussion of a political end state. Napoleon has the levy en masse, and that's where everybody can serve in the military. Everything that the country does is for the military now and for the conquest. And you have, you know, the continual discussions and intrigue, political intrigues, diplomatic intrigues, alliances dissolving, alliances being made, you know, the various struggles for power in Europe. And it's a fascinating thing. The more I've read about it for the time and how those countries evolved and how geography evolved those countries, with Germany in between Russia and France, and all the conflicts that have resulted from those three different types of peoples and what their struggles have been. But what Napoleon does is he organizes a military and he moves it faster than people's imaginations can even
comprehend.
They just cannot comprehend how fast this military is moving. And really, this is like the beginning of 1805. Napoleon's, you know, he's poised to invade Britain, but opportunity presents itself elsewhere, and the possibility of him invading Britain is debatable. So he's able to organize these armies into corps. They march faster, they move faster, they employ artillery, they have these structures about them that just confound their adversaries. And the Prussian military, who's supposed to be this, you know, the well-oiled machine of Frederick the Great, that was a key contributor to the, you know, the victory in the 7 Years' War 50 years earlier, just crumbles, just falls to pieces. And Russia is, you know, Russia is just baffled by this, and they're asking for peace. They're trying to keep keep France out of out of Russia. And this is like 1805 to 1809. England they'd found this method that worked with the subsidizing of other forces to do their fighting for them while they're fighting a grander battle. And so you have England fighting, but subsidizing small wars in Spain. And this is guerrilla warfare. This is, not the warfare that everybody's used to fight kind of in France's rear area. And it's sucking up forces from Napoleon, and it's sucking up money from Napoleon and focus from Napoleon. And England only has a couple battalions there. But they're finding a place where small investments are having an outsized impact on their overall strategy. Napoleon is not a maritime thinker at all as well. So again, going back to the discussion of the domains, Napoleon, you know, this is well earlier, but the Louisiana Purchase. So one of the largest land acquisitions for the United States comes from Napoleon, because his navy continually gets picked off by the British Navy as they're trying to operate any sort of economic gains or any sort of economic activities on the continental U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Britain just outclasses them. Master and Commander, that if you've seen that movie, that's another Russell Crowe movie. but that's about the habitual global battles of man at war ships between France and Great Britain in this period of time. The Battle of Trafalgar in 1805, Admiral Lord Nelson's his utter destruction of the French Navy, and so Napoleon he has no capability to use the seas to his advantage, whether it's economically or militarily, or whatever. He's not a naval planner. No one can touch him on land, but he eventually allows France to be isolated by sea. And so he's in this cycle, the strategic decision-making cycle, where the only way for him to economically sustain his empire is continual conquest across land.
Mm-hmm.
And so that leads to, like, I think it's 1809 to 1812, a rejuvenation of hostilities across the continental Europe, and eventually by 18, and it's fascinating because Napoleon, he's emperor, he marches all the way to Moscow. The Russians, instead of giving him Moscow, burn Moscow down himself. There's this Battle of Borodino that's this just epic. Napoleon returned with a third of the forces that he started out with, and it's an epic retreat across the great plains of Europe, where there's just, you know, it's just a sea of grass, and there's nothing for sustainment for the military as it's retreating, and the soldiers are tired, and they're done with the campaigning, and, you know, it's cold, and it's an epic story. All these things are occurring, and the battles and the tactics and everything that go along with it, they're all fascinating stuff. The thing that I think one of the biggest points I've taken out of the Napoleonic era is that intellectually, as it relates to us now, as a U.S. military, and specifically and principally as a Marine Corps, our doctrinal foundations, our doctrine, our common set of understanding and perception is, it quotes this guy named Clausewitz. And Clausewitz was a Prussian, and then he worked for the Russian military against Napoleon, and he's witness to all these things. And there's this other military philosopher, Jomini. Jomini is a kind of an adjutant of Napoleon's. And then there's this other guy, Tolstoy. Tolstoy writes all these epic novels, but War and Peace, one of the most epic novels ever written. They're all about the events occurring on the European continent from 1793 to 1815. And Clausewitz is especially, it's like we were talking about, you read our foundational document, MCDP1. It's like 93 pages if you pick the book up, but the book's a small book with big print on it. It's probably actually like 40 pages.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of been the defining document of the Marine Corps, first as FMFM1 and now as MCDP1,
mm-hmm.
Coming out of the restructure from Vietnam. And it quotes Clausewitz more than anybody else. Mm-hmm. I mean, it quotes Clausewitz, it quotes Sun Tzu, it quotes John Boyd, but more so than anybody is it's quoting Clausewitz.
I'm sad to admit that when you first brought this up, I didn't know what that was. And from what I understand and what I've read so far, I highly recommend any Marine to read that right now, especially NCOs, obviously corporal sergeants, and of course young officers.
Yep.
Yeah. Sorry.
No. Absolutely. So this, what Napoleon did, what transpired from his decision making, how he captivated the minds of the Western world for his time in power, and is an extremely you know, it's a fascinating study. Like I said, all the philosophers that we most closely ally to, or most closely like examine their documents, just like in antiquity they examined Homer, and whether or not you agreed with everything, all of Homer's premises, the Homer's premise was what was the foundation for the debate. Clausewitz is that now for the majority of our professional military education empire. Clausewitz, Jomini, Tolstoy is in there, and they're all focused on Napoleon, and they're all focused on the land campaigns and the you know, the tactics, the operations, the motivation, the still a question of how could this one man harness so much power and wield so much power by himself in a, you know, in a society where he didn't trace his lineage back to Achilles. He wasn't born into nobility. He's like Napoleon is the first kind of self-appointed great man from just normal, you know, from a normal birth and recognized at that. And his power was derived more, so much more so from just what he did as a human than what was perceived of his, you know, of his lineage.
So, would you argue that is because of his tactical minds that what that brought him into power?
I think there's
well, one of the reasons that it was.
I mean, I think he was a unique person to seize the opportunity that was presented when it was, mm-hmm. and then do the most with it. That he possibly could. Mm. He was brilliant. There's no doubt that he was brilliant. But that brilliance may have been lost if there was never the opportunity with the turmoil and the government and the changing of how France viewed itself as a nation at the time.
And you said that, I believe you told me that his title was that like of the last great man.
So yes, and that's something. I mean, that's up for debate. But aside from these military philosophers that still resonate with us doctrinally, Napoleon was probably the last battlefield commander mm-hmm. that could do it all himself.
Mm.
He could. So, you know, you're in the G8. I'm in the G3. We have a G1, a G2, a G4, a G6, and we have other special staff mm-hmm. members. And we all kind of have our functions that we perform, and our MOSs are more or less based off of those functions. And that's how we organize ourselves for planning and for execution.
But Napoleon was a jack of all trades.
Yes, and there was no structure like that then. This structure for a staff started to come after Napoleon, or the organization started to come after Napoleon. It was Napoleon, and he had marshals, mm-hmm. and he had a whole baggage train of people, but he read every report. He dictated reports. I mean, they talk about a lot of his handwritten dictations are still available, and it's just like the estimate of the type of person it took to be able to read all that, comprehend all of it, and then make coherent decisions based off of it is it's a very unique person. And he's probably the last person that could do it all himself at the magnitude and the scale that he did.
You know, here's an interesting question. So, as you said, we each have our own job, and I feel like a lot of the Marines, we talked about a little bit about Romans and how they got essentially, I think it was the Romans we talked about this, how they got basically lazy without a war effort, kind of complacent.
Mm-hmm.
And I would argue that that's a thing amongst people in the Marine Corps now. They have one job. They do the bare minimum of that job, and they don't know any other part of the unit as a whole, right? Do you think that should be, going forward, and as we develop the military, the Marine Corps as a future, I think that should be a point of interest for Marines that are coming in? Or do you think my question really comes down to, Napoleon was able to do all this by himself, right? Mm-hmm. He didn't need a structure in order to be a very efficient commander, leader, whatever. But also the other end of the spectrum is that if one Marine is part of a whole, knows his job so well and but only does that job, is that which one is more efficient?
Well, Napoleon lost. So.
You know what? That is an excellent point.
Our education system in the military is developed to, it's developed to broaden a Marine's understanding of their role,
mm-hmm.
concurrently with what is anticipated of that Marine's ability to perform their role to mastery,
mm-hmm.
I guess would be a way to put it. So, for like the school I taught at, or I was a faculty advisor at, Expeditionary Warfare School. So mm-hmm. school for captains, you have anywhere from Marines with 4 to maybe 7 years experience in there. And it did not matter if you were an intelligence officer or a logistics officer or an infantry officer or whatever it may be. The school was designed that as we went through and we planned all these different types of combat operations that we could expect to be a part of throughout our career, that you would fill a role that was not specifically not your MOS. So the intel officers never played the role of the intel officer in whatever planning exercise we were mm-hmm. doing. I had a comptroller officer that, we made him the operations officer of a MU, not because he was a comptroller, but because he had demonstrated proficiency in all the planning tasks up to that point in the curriculum, that he was the person to best fulfill that role. And so that was the point of the school. And then command and staff, the next level up, the school for field grade officers is of a similar structure, to where that's, you have to master your skill, but you have to learn how your skill is just one piece of a whole. And then when conflict comes, or when in any of these environments, the side that's able to optimize the use of everybody's talents to create advantage is, that's the causal factor or the theory of victory. But being able to assess that and being able to determine whether you're doing that in relation to your adversary is that's tricky. Back to Napoleon, like he could do it on land, but when he made when he was part of the Louisiana Purchase, in one book I read, the quote attributed to him was, "By selling this to the United States, it'll make them a first-rate power in the next century." Mm-hmm. And that was absolutely true. He couldn't maintain the empire outside of the European continent. That's it. Maybe a little shorter on this one, but what?
No, it's about the same.
Yeah. Well, what we get from Napoleon into the next thing, so we'll talk Civil War next.
Mm-hmm.
And the world had never seen someone move an army from Paris, the distance of Paris to Moscow, mm-hmm. in the time that it took Napoleon to do it. Although when he got to Moscow, he had culminated. He had gone beyond his capability to continue operations,
mm-hmm.
and the world had never seen that before.
Mm-hmm.
The American Civil War makes that look like an everyday occurrence with the ability, with the railroad and the telegram, but also with a lot of the intangible aspects of that conflict. And so what I'm going to try and highlight beyond what we all understand of the Civil War is these distances, these volumes, and this mass of warfare, what had captivated people's imaginations by Napoleon was taken in a civil war and in a war over the soul of a country accelerated the lethality of conflict leaps and bounds beyond what these interstate wars had been in Europe.
You heard it here first, folks. We're going to talk about the Civil War next episode. What else are we going to be covering on the next episode, sir? Cool, me asking. I haven't gone over this yet.
No, Civil War. We'll see how that goes, and then we can, and then Civil War set the stage for World War One, and maybe a little bit of, you know, a little bit of World War One.
Well, I think it's about time to wrap it up.
Yeah.
Another successful episode.
Yeah, I've enjoyed this. Thank you.
I've also thoroughly enjoyed it. Yeah. You seem very passionate about history, so it's always a pleasure having someone talk about something they're so passionate about, especially when it's as interesting as this and as much as it affects us now, especially us in the MEB.
Well, I mean, these stories and stuff that we talk about here, too, I think the idea that, you know, 1,000 years from now, 2,000 years from now, whatever remains or whatever is left or in the world, the idea of America is going to be a central focus for it, and people are going to look back on the United States of America and learn a lot of lessons from it, and part of that is how it was able to do the things that it did and who did those things, and you know, they're not going to remember me. But they'll talk about Marines.
You never know. This podcast could blow up big. You know, this will be. Yeah. Joe Rogan, watch out. We're about to really blow up.
But the idea, the you know, what did that, how did that society cultivate the people that were willing to do those things on its behalf? And how did it do it for so long? And how did it keep itself from an Adrianople? Or keep itself from a decline in its capability? How did it always continually find those people that were willing to do more than what they needed to, and to be a part of that, knowing full well that there's either easier things to do? They could get compensated more generously for a lot less sacrifice in many other pursuits, but the society still produced a desire and enough of its people to, you know, to perform the things that we do, that it kept the country what it was.
Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. Well, again, thank you for coming.
Absolutely, thank you.
We'll have you on the next episode, and most likely the one after that. And you know, we have tons to talk about. You know, you could see a fifth episode in the future.
Yeah, we'll be closing in on the Marine Corps birthday. So I'll try and, as we get more modern oriented. You know, something that's impactful for that for that event.
All right. Thank you again to everyone tuning in. Again, in the next episode, we'll be covering history once more with Major Wilson. Again, remember to stay ready, resilient, and relevant. All right, I'm going to go try to fit into my blues now. Bye.